This is the Education Gadfly Show.
I forgot how personal this is.
Yeah. I don't know what to say. It wasn't fun, but I agreed with it.
What does Gadfly say?
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute. We're the Education Gadfly Show and online at fordhaminstitute.org. And now, please welcome my special guest for this week, Devin Carlson. Devin, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mike. I'm happy to be here.
Hey, we're thrilled to have you, Devin. Devin is Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Oklahoma, also the Associate Director for Education at the National Institute of Risk and Resilience. Woo. Also joining us, as always, David Griffith.
Hey, thanks, Mike.
All right. So, Devin, we were chatting before the show. It sounds like transitioning to teaching is going pretty well, and you're also getting to transition to some homeschooling for your six-year-old and eight-year-old. That going okay also?
Yeah, it's going pretty well. It's given me a new appreciation for what teachers do on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. You know, what I've noticed, Devin, is we talked about this a little bit last week, is that I am also struck by something you've covered in some of your studies, is just what happens after school and on the weekends. I mean, it's one thing to replace teaching, and some schools are going in that direction now. Man, a whole other thing to figure out what to do from 3 o'clock to 9 p.m. every day and all day long on Saturday and Sunday when there's none of these scheduled activities for us helicopter parents.
Oh, it is. It's a different world. And, you know, the kids miss their friends, and figuring out how to maintain those connections is something that's also tough to figure out.
Absolutely. I've started wondering about the fall. And, you know, if schools are back in, that would be great. But there is talk about how, you know, maybe anything that has crowds will not be allowed. And you think, oh my God, does that mean no Friday night lights, no football games, no musical theater or choir concerts? I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm being too pessimistic about that, but it could be a very strange school year.
It could. I don't think we've seen anywhere near the end of the oddness that's accompanied this.
All right. Well, we have got a lot to cover because we are doing one of our special research deep dives. This is the third installment. This is where we step back from the usual ed reform debate of the day and from the research minute, and we ask, what do we know about a given topic? Kind of like a review article, but in podcast form. And so we are very excited to tackle with you the topic of school closures. Now, of course, we are living through mass school closures like never before in American history because of the COVID and coronavirus crisis. That's not so much what we're talking about. We're really today going to be talking about schools that are closed, either because of poor performance, which happens certainly in the charter school sector every so often in the traditional public school sector, or more likely because of declining enrollment and the like. We want to try to understand the impact of those closures. For a long time in the accountability world, we have talked about the importance of having some intervention for the schools that just seem resistant to any kind of attempt at improvement. And certainly some of us, myself included, have argued, look, there may be some schools that are so dysfunctional or under-enrolled that the best thing you can do is close them down. Maybe start over, maybe not. We're going to unpack what the impact is on students, as far as we know, from lots of different research studies. So if you're ready for it, let's do our research deep dive.
Let's do it.
All right. So, Devin, you know, the first place to start is with the basics, is, you know, what is the impact of school closures on the students in the schools that are closed? When they move to another school, do they lose ground? Do they learn more? Do they learn less? Do we know anything beyond just the basic test scores? Tell us about it.
Sure. So, you know, at this point, there's been studies examining closures in a wide variety of different areas. We've seen work in Ohio. I've done that work with Stefan Levertu. We've seen work from Michigan, Pittsburgh, Chicago, New York City, New Orleans, Philadelphia. So we've really accumulated a pretty nice set of studies that analyze the effects of this intervention. The effects on students in closed schools across these studies are kind of all over the place. There's a small number of studies, notably those in Pittsburgh and a Chicago study, that find some negative impacts, at least initially. On the other hand, my work on closing charter schools in Ohio and Doug Harris's work on closing charter schools in New Orleans finds big positive impacts. So we were talking 0.2, 0.3 standard deviations, which is really large in the effect size world. Studies in Michigan, the broader study in Ohio, work from Philadelphia is kind of in between, maybe some small positive effects, not really negative effects. So if I had to characterize it all, I'd say it's context specific, but in general, the effects are either null, no effects at all, or slightly positive. with a couple outliers on either side.
Let's unpack that a little bit. I mean, it sounds like it's one thing if we're talking about charter schools, it might be something somewhat different if districts. In the charter context, you know, these are generally schools closed for low performance, right? And in the district context, maybe not so much. Is that maybe what's driving it?
I think absolutely. I mean, both Ohio and New Orleans have targeted closure at the lowest performing charter schools in their respective contexts. I mean, Ohio has its automatic closure law. New Orleans has a very strict policy of trying to eliminate the lowest performing charter school in that city. And so when you're eliminating the lowest performing, the lowest quality schools, almost by definition, students have to go to higher quality students and you're going to see more positive impacts. In other contexts, though, where closure is not as closely tied to performance, that's where you see these effects that are smaller in magnitude, either no effects at all, slight positive, maybe slight negative. And so when you tie closure to performance, we've seen in the literature much larger effects than if it's based on declining enrollment or some other consideration.
No, that makes sense. And also this finding that maybe it's different if you're talking about very short term versus longer term. Seems like there's in the research literature, there's been for a long, long time, we've known that most kids, just when they switch schools or anything, yeah, they tend to lose some ground. And so, you know, all the school choice studies, for example, well, if you look in just the first year, yeah, you might find that they've lost ground, even if they're moving into a very high performing school. But, you know, then they might really start making big progress in years two or three. And it sounds like we're seeing, to some degree, we see that pattern here as well.
That is one of the constants across this literature, is that the effects are larger or better the farther you go out in time. So you might see that initial disruption in year one, but years two and three and four tend to look better. And whether those end up positive or null overall kind of depends on the specific context we're looking at.
Yeah, jump in here.
What you got, David? Really quickly, Devin. I'm curious on a couple points that I either didn't absorb when I was trying to wrap my head around this literature or didn't notice. Can you tell us, are there any apparent or suggestive differences between elementary and middle and high school?
You know, most of the literature so far has focused on elementary and middle school. There's not really been a whole lot of work at the high school level. The one study at the high school level that I'm aware of is work out of New York City that found the closure of low-performing high schools in New York City had no effect on students who were in the schools at the time they were phased out, but actually increased the performance and the likelihood of graduation of students who would have attended those schools had they remained open.
Right.
So on the high school side, that's about the only evidence, or there's also some evidence from New Orleans, I guess, where Doug Harris and his colleagues found that closures in New Orleans had some positive impacts at the high school level, but closures in Baton Rouge had some negative impacts.
Well, what about urban versus rural? I mean, intuitively, you know, it's more practical in an urban setting, right, where there's some sort of alternative.
Most of the literature has been conducted in urban contexts. My study with Stefan in Ohio did look at rural areas and generally found no impacts on student test scores. When we focused in on the Big Eight urban districts in Ohio, we saw positive impacts. Quentin Brummett's work did look at some in Michigan, did look at some rural schools. But in general, there has not been as much focus on closures in rural areas, which is interesting because if you go back to the 70s, there's a lot of work on district consolidation, which entailed school closure. Now that works a little bit out of date, given that it was done 30, 40 years ago, but the focus on rural closures has not been nearly as significant lately as the focus on closures in urban areas.
All right. The next big question then is, what about the kids in the schools where the other kids end up? In other words, a school closes, this group of kids now have to go somewhere else. They land in other schools. And what is the impact on their new peers? I guess in the research literature, you call these spillover effects. That works fine. So what then happens? Certainly, I remember there were some fascinating studies out of Hurricane Katrina about what happened when evacuees landed in schools in, for example, Houston,
sure,
which was mostly some pretty negative impacts on the kids who were in those Houston schools, when kids who came in were fairly low performing and maybe discipline had disruptive discipline issues as well. What do we know in the context of these school closures?
So there's been two studies that have really taken this on nicely, and that's Quentin Brummett's work from Michigan and Matt Steinberg and John McDonald's work from Philadelphia, and they both find some negative spillover effects. They're not huge, you know, they're 0.01, 0.02 standard deviation, so not big, but when you spread that across the whole set of students in the building, you know, that adds up to some sort of, you know, non-trivial test score declines. Other studies haven't looked at that as closely. The work in Pittsburgh did try to take some look at it. I think the work in Michigan and Philly did a little bit better job, but in general, I read the evidence on spillovers to be generally negative.
help us out here a little bit from a utilitarian perspective, right? Maybe this isn't a question that can be answered, right? But I always have to ask it. You know, we've made the point on previous podcasts, and when we did this with discipline, actually, you know, we made the point that arguably the benefits from suspensions, at least the test-based benefits from suspensions for other kids in the classroom, when you added them all together, like you were saying, across all these kids, were larger than the negative impact on the kids who were suspended. And so that's sort of a moral quandary. This sort of seems inverted a little bit. Is it possible to say, you know, if you added up all these effects, is sort of the net effect positive or negative in the short term?
I haven't been able to come away with a clean judgment as to what the net effects are. I mean, I think that's something you have to consider, that the effects of displaced students may be one direction, the effect on the spillover effects go in another direction. And I don't think you can come away with a clean quantitative estimate of whether the net effects are positive or negative. I mean, you could estimate it, but in general, I think it's more of a values question. Do you want to potentially increase the achievement of the students in the schools you're closing at the potential expense, small expense, of students in schools receiving those students? And I'm not sure there's a quantitative or statistical answer to that question. That's one that has to be, I think, decided and engaged through the political and decision-making process that accompanies closing schools.
All right, that was a cowardly answer, but I'll let it pass.
It was.
But Devin and David, let me get at this a different way. I mean, maybe it's more about methodology. Like, is the concern that, hey, we're basically just moving kids around. And so, you know, of course, what we're picking up on is just there's low performing kids here and high performing kids here or whatever. And now we've just moved them around. The schools themselves are not having differential impact on their student achievement. It's just that you've now moved low achieving kids from school A into school B. You know what I'm saying? So in other words, are we picking up on anything that has to do with the quality of the schools, or is this just all about moving kids around?
I mean, I think it's probably mostly peer effects, right? I mean, the sort of pattern of findings would be consistent with, I think, a combination of closing low quality schools and the reality that peer effects do exist. And so when you move some lower performing students into a different context, you know, that's going to lower average achievement levels in that school more generally. And on top of that, there might also be some peer effects that bring down test scores a slight bit more. It's worth noting that the estimates of these spillovers are not big, right? It's like at most one percentile point.
All right. So let me see if I can put what the two of you are saying together. I mean, I'll buy that it's peer effects, right? I'm not sure what else it could be when you're moving the kids into a new school, right? So it is intuitive, right? You move some kids, they're disrupted, and that disruptive sort of disruption spills over. But when you're talking about closing the school, right, that strikes me as an inherently seemingly simple, but actually pretty complicated intervention, right? I mean, sure. You're removing kids from an environment where potentially they're all subject to negative peer effects. But in the process, right, you're also sort of implicitly replacing the principal, right? Implicitly replacing 100% of the teaching staff. I don't know. I guess I just, unless we feel like it really doesn't matter what we do between 8 a.m. and 3 p.m. or who does it, I guess the assumption here is that we're identifying low performing schools based on value added, right? And not based on achievement. Maybe you could speak to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think studies that I've been considering when talking about that, they do work to identify them on value added, not on achievement levels. On the other side, districts have not always identified school for closure on the basis of value add. They've considered achievement levels and performance levels as a basis for closure. And so that's problematic, obviously, if you're trying to maximize test scores. The other thing I'll say that we haven't really touched on is that closing schools has the potential to free up fiscal resources that can be better allocated to those that remain open. I've not seen good work in the literature about how the reallocation of dollars from closed schools to those that remain open might have affected outcomes in those schools. But that's a rationale that a lot of districts cite, that limiting some of these fixed costs and reallocating those dollars towards our schools that remain open has the potential to increase student outcomes, particularly in light of all the recent evidence that matters.
All right, good. All right, I'm going to follow up on that in just a moment. One last bit. Tell us about the impact of closing schools on neighborhoods. That is something that we think at least one study has looked at.
Yeah, there's a study out of Philadelphia that shows that crime fell in blocks where schools were closed. High schools were closed in particular. And the crime reductions occurred during school hours. And crime did increase in the blocks where students subsequently attended school. But the increase of crime in those blocks was not sufficient to overcome the decline of crime in the blocks around the closed schools, which led to a net reduction in crime as a result of closing high schools. I have some ongoing work in Ohio that attempts to estimate the effect of school closures on home prices, where we know that, you know, you hear rhetoric and anecdotal stories how schools are kind of the center of communities and neighborhoods. And when those schools get shut down, it seems like there's a possibility that it leads to a decline in the neighborhood more generally. And we're using data from Zillow to try to gain broad insight into how that dynamic might play out. So I think there's more work to do on the neighborhood front, but there is some interesting evidence out there.
Very cool. All right. So let's try to summarize. And I know, Devin, as a researcher, you will push back on my attempts to give clear advice to policymakers. But hey, you know, look, unfortunately, we are heading into another very bad recession, if not worse. There seems to be a good chance that this is going to eventually mean fewer resources for schools as state and local taxes dry up. And so, you know, there's going to be resource constraint. There may be, therefore, another round of school closures in some places that are under-enrolled and figure out that keeping these buildings open is costing too much money. And so I guess the question would be, if you're going to close schools and you want good things to happen for kids, number one, do it on the basis of performance. In other words, close the lowest performing schools, the most value-added schools. And number two, make sure that the kids get to go to new schools that are markedly better. And number three, if you're in the charter school sector, absolutely keep closing bad schools down for performance if you want to help kids. Is that fair? Am I putting too many words in your mouth?
I think that's fair if we're focusing on test scores, but I think it's worth recognizing that closing schools is a really multidimensional decision. Schools are the fabrics of communities, and you know, the politics around school closure is tough. It's difficult. If we're looking to increase test scores, I think that what you put forth is the way to go. But I want to acknowledge and highlight just how multidimensional that decision ultimately is.
Well said. And to be clear, it's painful. I think we've seen that the public hates it. Politically painful. There's no doubt about it. It's only something now, I think, going forward that's going to happen when districts are in desperate straits. But unfortunately, some of them are probably heading in that direction.
Just a couple things that I feel like we haven't really given sort of spent enough time on. One point I guess I would just want to draw out is Devin mentioned the one study, I think it's the New York study, that looked at, you know, how many kids didn't attend a low-performing school in the first place, right? You know, the kids who would have attended it that didn't attend it at all because it didn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
Maybe you can speak to this, Devin, but I mean, my assumption has always been that's where most of the benefits lie. Yes, the obvious point is to look at the kids who are displaced and see how they're doing, but you have to account for like the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, however many years you want to go of kids who aren't going into a very low performing school to begin with and are not displaced in any way. And so I guess I would just sort of emphasize that point, which is I don't know if probably don't have the ability to quantify that conclusively, but I just don't think we should miss that point.
No, and you know, the New York City study is the only one that I'm aware that has actually taken that view seriously. And it shows clear benefits for students who would have attended a local, one of those closed schools, but ultimately didn't because it didn't exist anymore. And so that is absolutely something to keep in mind, is what this closure looks like for future cohorts of students that no longer have an opportunity, or you know, whatever the opposite of an opportunity is, to attend that school, who would no longer attend that school.
Great. And one more thing I guess I wanted to bring up was, is there any consensus at this point? I mean, one thing I know that sometimes happens, right, is that schools will close, but they will close one grade at a time. So for example, a high school might stop accepting ninth graders, right? But you know, it'll let the 11th graders finish their senior years, right, instead of switching to another school. Do you have any thoughts on that? Has there sort of been any in more clarity there, or either in terms of what schools are actually doing, how they close, or how you think they should close?
There's been a little bit of work on this, and in the New Orleans study looked at phase outs versus immediate closures and found that phase outs were more favorable for students than those immediate shutdowns. Same thing. Well, New York City looked separately at the phase out students and the future cohorts who would have attended and didn't find any negative impacts for the phase out students.
Is the counter argument just that it costs money?
I mean, that might be part of it, and that it just delays the inevitable and delays. You have to have the next operator willing to take over grades one at a time. And so I think logistically it might make things drawn out over a longer time period than just an immediate shutdown and turn over to a new operator. But interestingly, a number of the studies find that the largest negative effects of closure occur in the last year that the school was in operation. So they announced this, the school's going to shut down, everybody stops trying, and the negative impacts hit really in that last year of operation of the school. school that's going to be closed.
As someone who worked at a school that was closed, I can say that finding is intuitive to me.
Yes, yeah. I forgot how personal this is for
me. Yeah, I don't know what to say. It wasn't fun, but I agreed with it.
All right. Well, wow, that was fantastic, Devin. Really appreciate it. Covered a ton of ground. And it does sound like there's a lot out there and yet plenty more to do. Listeners will notice we mostly talked about test scores because for the most part, that's all we've got so far for most of these studies, right? You know, except for now some of these neighborhood effects that folks are looking at. But the longer term things that at least in some other contexts people have been able to look at is still kind of TBD. So we'll have to have you come back on sometime, Devin, when the research literature gets even bigger.
Yeah, I love that.
All right. So again, Devin Carlson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Oklahoma, also at the National Institute of Risk and Resilience. He's the Associate Director for Education. Appreciate you coming on the show. And until next week,
I'm David Griffith.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at fordhaminstitute.org.